Well, we're finished looking at the book of Acts for now. No doubt we'll come back to it at some time. And for the next few weeks, in fact for the next 10 weeks, unsurprisingly, we'll look at the Ten Commandments. 10 weeks after this one, to be strictly accurate. I don't know what you think when you think Ten Commandments. I know every week at Christchurch we have a range of people from sort of fully committed Ned Flanders Christian through to pretty sceptical. Most people, I think, view the Ten Commandments, or at least view the back half of the Ten Commandments, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't commit murder, as more or less good rules for life. You know, we don't want a society of murderers, adulterers, thieves and the like. But the top half, have no gods before me. Don't make any idols. Keep the Sabbath day. Don't take my name in vain. Well, they're sort of, they're a little bit old, a bit out of date. A little bit 2nd century BC, which is roughly when they were written. Even Christians, so even those who would say they believe the Bible, can look at the Ten Commandments and think, well, they're just a bit Old Testament. You know, I like the Jesus stuff, I like the Sermon on the Mount, I like, but the sort of, well, it's law, it's rules. I'm all about sort of loving God and a personal relationship, and I don't like being told what to do. Surely we've moved beyond that as we move into the New Testament. Surely now it's about the Spirit, about... And so again, in a less, perhaps a less sort of obvious way, we just push the commandments to one side. What I want to do today, therefore, is really just spend a few minutes explaining why we should still care about the Ten Commandments. Why is it that they matter, frankly, whether we're Christian or not? Why should I bother? I thought about doing a quick test, whether without looking we could get from 1 through 10. And then I thought, best not. might get depressed. I wonder, just in your head, do you think you could do it? Especially if you're a Christian, do you think you could get from 1 to 10? Do you think you could do it in order? Doesn't matter too much about the order, probably. But a generation ago, no worries. In fact, most people, even just at school, would have been taught the Ten Commandments. They might not have believed them, but they'd be able to tell you them. Now, I'd guess less. So why take an interest? First thing we need to understand about these commandments is that we obey the commandments as a response to being rescued, not as a way to be rescued. Okay? Christians should obey the commandments as a response to having been rescued, not as a way to get rescued. Now, what does that mean? Although we're going to be looking at the commandments sort of one by one over the next few weeks, they actually come in the middle of a story, the story of the Israelites. If you remember that one, it's the story when the people of God, the Jewish people essentially, were enslaved in Egypt. And Pharaoh was making them build the pyramids, making them build his cities, and treating them horrifically. The baby boys were being thrown in the river. They were being whipped. They were in slavery. God came. And through Moses told Pharaoh to let the people go, to let his Jewish people go. And Pharaoh, of course, refused. And you remember what happens? The plagues build up. Some of the early ones are sort of annoying, gnats and things, but not too bad. By the end of the plague, the 10 plagues, the Passover, when the eldest male in each family dies, they are horrific. We're not meant to read those kind of stories and smile. It is a terrible story. That's what it takes to defeat the Israelites' enemies, Pharaoh, and get out of the land. So they escape through the desert, they escape through the Red Sea, and finally they come to Mount Sinai. And on Mount Sinai, having escaped from Egypt, God comes and says, "Now, I've rescued you, therefore live like this." So look down at chapter 20 and verse 1 and 2. God spoke all these words saying, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." That's the first commandment. The story goes, rescue, and then the rules. And it's really important we get those in the right order. Rescue first, then rules. What God doesn't do is come to the Israelites back at the beginning of the story when they're in slavery, and frankly, they're not living that well. It's not that they were sort of pure, holy people who were just unfortunately in slavery. They were worshipping other gods. They were no better than the Egyptians. God didn't come to them in that state and say, "Now, here are 10 rules. If you obey them, keep these 10 rules, if you obey them, I'll come and rescue you. If you're good enough, keep 8, 9 out of 10, I'll take you out of Egypt and I'll bring you to the promised land. Now, he rescued them purely out of his mercy, out of his love, and then showed them how to live. Rescue first, then the rules. And as you go on in the Bible, what you realize is actually this story, which becomes probably the most important story in the Old Testament, this story has always been a picture of a much greater rescue that God was going to accomplish. You see, the Bible will tell us that actually all of us, whether we're Jewish or not, all of us are in a form of slavery. Slavery, not likely for us, at least in England, in a physical sense, but a spiritual slavery. We are unable to be the kind of people that God calls us to be. We know we should be good, but we're not. Again, religious or not, it doesn't matter. We don't live as we should. God calls us to love one another, and we don't. We love ourselves. God calls us to worship him, and frankly, we couldn't care less about it. And that doesn't leave us unchanged. That leaves us in a kind of bondage. I don't know if you ever tried for a week trying to be a good person, trying to cut out the things about yourself that you know are not good. It just doesn't work, does it? You last an hour or 2 hours. You might last a day, but you never last long. Or you look at society as a whole, and we're told in the modern world that with science and all the advances and everything, we're a much better society. It's not true, is it? We get more advanced, and we just think of more advanced ways of causing mayhem. 20th century, more people killed than all the other in warfare, sorry, than in all the other centuries put together. I don't think it's that we're worse in the 20th century. It's just by the 20th century, we invented more ways of causing trouble. Bigger bombs, faster jets. So that slavery that for the Israelites was kind of physical, they're stuck in Egypt, for us is spiritual. We're slaves to sin. But the parallels go a bit further. Just as the Israelites had an enemy, Pharaoh, who kept them in slavery, well, so we're told that human beings have an enemy. In fact, a number of enemies. Forces that are too powerful for us to beat. So death would be an obvious one. Death in the New Testament is called an enemy. It doesn't matter who you are. You could be the richest man in the world. You could be the most beautiful woman in the world. Or you could be the sort of sharpest, most intelligent doctor. You cannot beat death. It is just going to come for you. It is an unbeatable enemy, like Pharaoh. And so we've got a slavery, like the Egyptians. We've got an enemy, in fact, several enemies, like the Jews had. And also, we've got a destination, a place we want to get to. Do you remember that the story of the Israelites wasn't just about getting them out of Egypt into the desert, and then God saying, well, there you go, guys, you know, anyway you like, now onwards. He brought them out to take them to the promised land. And the promised land, Canaan, or Israel as we know it now, was meant to be a picture of heaven. It was never meant to be the end in and of itself. Of course, God was going to put the Jews in the promised land. But it was a visual aid, if you like, a pointer to something much bigger. The fact that God wants to move all of humanity from slavery to sin, an enemy too big to beat, death, into a fantastic world. A world without death or pain or suffering or sin, this slavery of sin. So the stories parallel each other. Why does it matter? Well, it matters because Christians tend to do exactly what we shouldn't do with the commandments. Just as God didn't come right back at the beginning of the story and say to the Israelites, if you obey these commandments, then I will save you. So God doesn't say to you, if you're a 21st century human being, if you obey the commandments, then you will be one of my children. If you're good enough, then I will save you. If you're good enough, I'll conquer death for you. If you obey the commandments, I'll let you into heaven, the promised land. Actually, the pattern is the same. It's not rules, and then he'll rescue. It's a free offer of rescue in which we respond to by then following the rules. The offer of the gospel, the New Testament offer, is that Jesus has lived the rules for us. The only man who ever lived all the Ten Commandments, later in his Sermon on the Mount, he says, I've not come to abolish the commandments, but to fulfill them. What's he mean there? He said, look, I've not come to say that it doesn't matter whether you commit adultery or whether you lie or steal or cheat. Of course it matters. It's not that God's just sort of gone soft and said, hey, Hitler, wait, whatever. I'm loving, forgiving, in you come. No, it matters what we do. We are guilty for our sin. But although I've not come to abolish them, I have come to fulfill them. What he means is he's come to live them for us, live them in our place. And that is the rescue that the Exodus was pointing to. Jesus coming, living the life we should have lived, and then offering to give us that record. So when I die, instead of me having to say to God, here's how I did on the Ten Commandments, I botched one, I was all right on three, terrible on four. Actually, all I have to say is, here's Jesus' record on the Ten Commandments. That's why Christianity is known as a religion of grace, not of works. God doesn't come and say, do this. He comes and says, this is done for you, if you'll accept it as a gift. Of course, lots of us don't like accepting gifts, because it's basically humbling to our pride. The first thing that you have to do to become a Christian is repent. And that means turning, not just from the bad things you do, but also from your own kind of self-righteousness. I have to be prepared to say, well, not just that I'll stop the thieving, the adultery and all the rest, but also I'll stop trying to prove myself to God. I'll stop having to say to God, look, I am a good person. I'll admit that I'm not, and that I need rescuing. And that, of course, takes humility. It punctures the balloon of our pride. Jesus' record is perfect. Ours isn't. Jesus conquers death for us, and offers it as a gift. Jesus opens up the gates of heaven, opens up, if you like, the way into the promised land for us, and again, offers it as a gift. But you can only take it as a free gift. You can't work for it. Now, I guess, if you've been a Christian for a while, a lot of this should be familiar territory. But especially this term, as we begin to look at the Ten Commandments, it's really important we keep things in their place. The rescue comes first, and the response is that we obey the rules. If we forget that and slip back into thinking, God mainly judges me on how I kept the rules, well, one of two things will happen. If I'm frankly not very good at them, okay, if I'm, I suppose, an honest person, and I start reading these rules, I'll realise that I'm no crack at them at all. I'm breaking them left, right, and centre. Of course, the rules are just the headline. Each one is the title of a much longer book, as you were. When Jesus comes and preaches, for instance, he takes do not murder and says, don't think you've fulfilled that commandment just because you haven't killed anyone. There may be no corpses in your backyard, but it's much more than that. He says again in the Sermon on the Mount, do not murder means, well, sure, do not murder. But also, don't even get angry with people. Where are we on that one? You say, I've never slept with anyone else's wife. I haven't committed adultery. But he says, look, do not even look at a woman lustfully. Where are we on that one? You see, when we start assessing ourselves, if we forget that the rescue, the forgiveness comes first, we're going to get incredibly depressed. We're going to feel like bad Christians, failure Christians. We'll look around at everybody else and think, well, they're doing okay and I'm terrible. I don't belong here. We're going to start thinking, God is down on me. God doesn't like me. And slowly, as the weight of guilt presses down, frankly, it just gets harder and harder to live a Christian life. Eventually, it'll crush you. If we go back to thinking it's rules first, we'll get crushed. Either that or we'll become insufferable. There are some people who look at the rules and think, do you know what, I've done them. I'm okay on all these. Ironically, I saw Ricky Gervais write an article on this recently. He's an atheist and still managed to finish the article saying that he reckoned he'd kept the Ten Commandments. Pretty impressive, given the first one is, you shall have no other gods before me. But either way, the kind of person who says, look, I've done all this. You know, I'm pretty much okay. I might not be perfect, but I'm pretty much there. That kind of person is just a pain in the neck, aren't they? The kind of person who's so full of their own self-righteousness, so full of their own perfection, that they spend the whole time looking down their nose at everybody else. That person has forgotten that they've got no hope of keeping the rules. That they need the rescue first. So whether we think we've done it, or whether we're crushed by them, the answer is the same. We need to realise we cannot do it, but God has done it for us. Rules follow rescue. I just want to say a couple more things about these commandments more specifically before we dive into the first one next week. The second important thing to realise about them is that actually these rules are also about relationship. Just look at chapter 19 and see how God expresses it. In chapter 19, the people of Israel are about to hear the commandments. Okay, so they've been rescued, and God is giving a speech to them before they actually get given the commandments. And just look how he talks about them. Say verse 4. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. I bore you on eagle's wings, you will be my treasured possessions. The language isn't sort of a nasty dictator, is it? Issuing laws from on high, just waiting to squish the people, hoping they'll go wrong so you can zap them with a lightning bolt. It's personal language. In fact, it's the same sort of language that Jesus uses. If you love me, you will obey my commandments. At the heart of the law was never just sort of cold, hard tablets of stone with rules carved on them. The heart of the law was always love. When Jesus is asked to summarize the law, essentially the Ten Commandments, he summarizes it as, love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, and mind. And when he gives that summary, that's not his sort of nice, soft New Testament take on the Old Testament. He's quoting the Old Testament, a bit from Deuteronomy, which we're not going to look at today. The law was always about love for God and love for neighbor. The second greatest commandment, Jesus said, is to love your neighbor as yourself. And again, he's quoting Leviticus, which is often pointed to as the sort of the nasty book of the Old Testament full of blood and gore. The law has always been about loving God. And again, if you're a Christian, you won't be able to even start to obey these commandments until you realize that love for God is central to them. When God brought the people out of Egypt, brought them into the desert, he brought them, not just, he rescued them, sorry, not just from Pharaoh, but for himself. God, we're never without a master. There's no human being who doesn't have a boss somewhere. We can say we're an atheist or agnostic or whatever, but at some point there's something that is our top priority. Our family, our money, our work, something is boss. It's impossible for human beings to live without having a top priority, essentially a God. When God rescues us to make him our top priority. That's why the first commandment is, I'm the Lord your God, have no other gods before me. When you've been rescued, you've got a new Lord. And the way you express your love to him is by obedience. And now sometimes that love is, I suppose, expressed through other people. So we're told to not to murder. Why are we told not to murder? Well, of course we're told not to murder because it's bad for other people. But also, when we remember that people are made in God's image, when each human being walking around the planet is a picture of God, that gives us a second incentive not to murder them, but also not to hate them, not to discriminate against them, not to abuse them when they're not there. In fact, it gives us another reason to love them, because it's not just the person we're loving, but also the fact that they're in God's image. As we look at them, we're meant to see God in them. And if this is the God who's rescued us, who saved us from death, from hell, from judgment, well, when we see God in them, it should spur us more to love them. The heart of the law is love. God calls us not just so we can go and do what we want, but so that we can be his people. And on that too, it's worth saying that the laws were not meant to be a way of killing all our joy, of shutting down our lives so that they're just incredibly dull. When the psalmists reflect on the law, when they look back on these commandments, they write songs about them. And in Psalm 19, the writer, we don't know his name, says this, "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. They're more to be desired than gold, and sweeter than honey, than drippings from the honeycomb." They don't see them as rules that ruin their life. They don't see them as the sort of catches, the small print of being a Christian. Well, it's great to sort of have eternal life, it's great to be forgiven, but the bummer is you've got to... No, the very pattern that God sets forth is the thing that sets them free. They view the law, strangely, as freedom. As you think about it, it makes sense. If God is the one who made us, which he's told us in verse 5, all the earth is mine. If God is also the one who loved us enough to rescue us, why would he then give us rules to spoil everything? Actually, the rules he gives us are to make our lives better, not worse. A designer, an engineer, knows best how to work a plane, doesn't he? the guys at Rolls-Royce should know best the rules for running the engines. You trust that when you get on their planes. Don't look nervous, Rolls-Royce people. Make me nervous. The architect of a building knows best at how the whole thing is going to function. Or similar, the designer of the universe, the creator of the universe, knows best how his creation should function. So when he gives us the rules, it's not to shut off all the fun options, but actually to guide us into the path that will make our lives most full of, well, Psalm 19, joy, revived souls, gold and honey, to take it as images of satisfaction. So the rules, far from shutting down our freedom, are there to set us free. And thirdly and finally, the final things that we need to keep in mind when we go through these commandments is that the rules aren't just for us, as it were. They're not just for a little Christian community, to sort of the sort of internal workings of a small club or a family. They're actually meant to be an outward witness to the nations. Look again at verse 5. If you chapter 19, verse 5. If you will keep, indeed hear my voice, keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. A kingdom of priests and a holy nation. It's not that all the Israelites were literally priests. Why were they a kingdom of priests? They had jobs, they were farmers and all the rest. They had daily lives. They weren't themselves sacrificing animals. And yet God calls them the kingdom of priests. Why? Well, a priest is a go-between, between God and man. And the idea was that as the Israelites obeyed God, they, a small nation, showed the best way to live. They showed what God was like. They showed that he was gracious and loving and forgiving. They showed that he knew the best way to live life. And the idea was that as Israel did that, then the nations around them, Egypt and Ammon and all the rest of them, looked in and saw, actually, yes, that is the way to live. And so those people too were drawn towards God. And then as the Egyptians did it, well, it steps out the step further to the Ethiopians and all the rest. And the gospel, as it were, the good news about God spreads out through the lifestyle of his people. In the New Testament, Peter the Apostle says this. And as I read these words, just look at verse 6. I'm not reading verse 6, I'm reading some words from 1 Peter. But Peter says to Christians this: you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, so that you might proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvellous light. Just like the Israelites, we're called to be a holy nation, a royal priesthood, a chosen race. Again, he's not talking about one nation there, but all Christians, whatever colour, whatever country they live in. The idea for the church is that you live such distinct lives that it reflects what God is like. There's huge pressure. You'll see this in the press all the time. Almost any time the church gets onto the news or Newsnight, it's some debate, isn't it? It's homosexuality or women ministers or something. It's always a fight. And almost always there'll be two representatives sat there on the panel. One of them will be saying, look, we live in the modern world. We've got to move with the times. We've got to change the rules, essentially. And the dynamic that's going on there, and you get this all the time going through church institutions, is we've got to make the church as much like the world as possible, because the more we become like the world, well, the more chance we have of surviving and growing. You know, more people will join the church if we become more and more like the world. But actually, that's completely wrong. It's utterly the opposite. There's plenty of research that shows that. On the whole, the firmer a denomination stays to its distinctives, even when the world is saying you've got to give up on that view, the firmer a church stays just to the same old simple beliefs, the longer it stands and the more it grows. And the more that it gives up its distinctives, the more that it tries to be cool and trendy like the world, well, the more it fades away. But we'd expect that not just from research, but from the Bible. Jesus told us to be a city on the hill. You will stand out, and that will have two effects. Some people will, of course, be pushed away by that. And we can't be responsible for that. We're not to be offensive. We're meant to be humble and gentle and loving. But you stand firm. On Newsnight, when I saw one of these debates recently, one of the church ministers said, look, the point of the church is to serve the country. And the other guy, who was a bishop, said, no, the first point of the church is to serve Jesus. Which is a far better answer. sometimes when we stand for some of the things entailed in these commandments, and they are much deeper, sometimes the world will not like it. But that's no reason to compromise. Peter himself says that Jesus divided opinion. It's not as if everyone flocked to him, did they? Eventually they crucified him. Christianity has never been completely in harmony with the world around. If it was, then what on earth is the point of someone becoming a Christian? There is no point. If Christianity and the world are just the same, well, you might as well stay in the world. No, the church is called to be different. Sometimes it will cause offence, just as Jesus did. But plenty of the time, and you see this in the most faithful churches, plenty of the time, actually the difference will slowly begin to attract. God's way of life is best. It is the most joy-giving. It's the most satisfying. And so if you just stick to it, not only is it good for you, yourself, as a Christian, it should have a positive trickle-down effect into the world. And also we pray that as you live that out, more and more people realise, and more new people from all tribes and tongues and nations come and realise that the God of grace offers them the same things. Eternal life, defeat of death, forgiveness for all that they've done. So the Ten Commandments, certainly about obedience to God, certainly about love for neighbour, certainly about satisfaction in our own lives, but also about mission in the world. Distinctive lives attract people to a distinctive God.